Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
So 37 industrialized countries in the world, 36 of them have national health care programs, and virtually all of them negotiate with drug companies, pharmaceutical companies. Many of them, if not most of them, have some very specific limits on what they will allow pharmaceutical companies to do because, in essence, pharmaceutical companies have become monopolies. And, of course, that's, you know, how you deal with monopolies. How should we be dealing with this? Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. John Cox is the first declared candidate for president on the Republican side. He actually declared his candidacy, 2 months ago, John?
Actually, I take that back. In March is when I really started to investigate it and traveled to Iowa, South Carolina, New Hampshire, and discovered that people were really ready for some different leadership in the Republican Party.
There you go. And your website is cox2008.com, the 2008 Republican presidential candidate. And you are saying that the United States should simply let the drug companies do whatever they want and charge us whatever they want.
No, I agree with you that the drug companies have gotten too big. They've been allowed to merge too much. I'm a Teddy Roosevelt Republican. I believe in the antitrust law. I believe in competition. Having said all that, the answer to competition is the answer to not enough competition, which is what we have with the drug companies, is to get more competition. It's not to turn over pricing policy to the government, and I think that's a very, very essential difference.
So you're suggesting that we should be using the Sherman Antitrust Act to break up the big pharmaceutical companies?
If that's what's necessary, absolutely. Not only
do you,
that,
do you really think any Republican could survive on a platform of breaking up big corporations?
Well, you know, I'd like to phrase it in a better way, and of course, you know, I would have fought some of those mergers to begin with. And let me tell you, I'm a Pfizer shareholder, but for them to buy Warner Lambert, I think, had some real problems with it. Again, the idea is more competition is better. What I'd like to do, Tom, is encourage more companies to get into the markets. I'd like to encourage more generics. I'd like to encourage, again, more competition. That gives us better quality, and it'll bring down the price. Price controls never bring down prices. You go back to Nixon's wage and price controls and the windfall profits tax and other things that try to use government's heavy hand on the markets, and they don't work. They sound good, but they just don't work.
Yeah, Nixon's wage and price controls were a temporary measure to deal with a crisis. And I don't think anybody thought that was going to be a long-term thing, and you're right, it didn't work. The windfall profits tax, I would say, probably actually did work, but that's a whole other argument.
Not at all. It depressed production, and when you get less production, you get higher prices. It's not the right thing to do.
Here we have a story. You're suggesting that basically we should be taking more of a hands-off approach with these companies, though.
No, I didn't say that at all. I said what we need to do is we need to, first of all, allow more companies to get into the business, which means we need to streamline the FDA. We need to end the trial lawyers' assault on this industry. We certainly need to have safe drugs, but we need to have a system that has some balance.
So if I get killed or my wife gets killed by a pharmaceutical company that's more interested in profit than they are in health, then I should not have the right to sue them.
No, you should have absolutely right to sue them, but what you don't want to have is suits that are based on junk science and suits that are just basically efforts.
Those kind of suits get thrown out of court.
Extortion. There's a difference, Tom. There really is. I mean, there's a balance to be made here. You can see that with what happened with Merck, with all those suits. Some of them, you know,
Merck knew that their drug was going to kill people, and they covered that up.
No, they didn't.
I can't believe that you're saying.
There have been 10 suits decided so far. I think Merck has won 8 of them. And these were juries. These were juries of peers that said, you know,
that's because they're going in one at a time, and it is, again, we're looking at an epidemiological situation where, you know, you've got, if you have 100,000 people and you know that a certain percentage of them, 2 or 3% of them are going to have heart attacks as a result of taking this drug, it's just like with tobacco. I mean, that's the argument that Merck is using in these individual court cases. Prove that particular heart attack was caused by this particular pill. It's damn near impossible to prove.
Tom,
But the fact of the matter is that the pill did cause some heart attacks.
Automobiles kill people, too. There's 40, 50,000 deaths every year on the
And it's Ralph Nader's lawsuits that caused them to get safer.
What?
And it was Ralph Nader's lawsuits that caused them to get safer.
But they're not safe. There's 40,000 people
they're safer.
On the highways every year. They're just not safe.
Well, obviously, we're not going to create a risk-free society, John, but it was lawsuits that moved the car industry into doing things like, you know, putting the gas tanks in the back and double sealing them and things like that.
I'm not against lawsuits, but I'm against a system that's unbalanced. I think anybody who really has...
No, the Republicans for a long time have been trying to defund the Democratic Party by blowing trial lawyers out of the water.
Tom, believe me, I'm a businessman. I know. I mean, there's lawyers that maintain suits so they can wring a settlement out of people because the cost of defending these things is so... outrageous. So, you know, that's what happened with Merck. You know, there's certainly, we want all drugs to be safe, but there is no risk-free.
Those lawsuits against Merck were, in every single one of those cases, those lawyers were taking a huge risk. And in the eight that were lost, they got wiped out. I mean, they lost. They didn't make any huge fortune.
Merck has not been wiped out.
The lawyers got wiped. The lawyers got hit. I mean, all of the expense, all of the research. That's why Merck and that's why the Republican Party are fighting against this being a class action lawsuit, which is what it really should be.
Now, you know, I you and I will agree to disagree. If you look at this, you look at the asbestos cases, you look at all these overreaching by lawyers. Again, I'm not against lawyers. I'm not against personal injury suits for people who damage people. I'm just interested in a little balance to this system. That's all, Tom.
We're talking about John Cox.
Part of getting new drugs into the marketplace.
Yeah, we're talking with John Cox. He's a Republican presidential candidate, 2008. Cox2008.com is website. John, front page of today's Wall Street Journal. For more than 20 years, Rashmi Bariyaya lived a comfortable life in New Jersey as a researcher for drug maker Bristol Myers Squibb, commuting from his 5-acre suburban estate in a blue Mercedes. Now, in a move that hints at a big shift in the global pharmaceutical business, he's back home in India. And then they go on to talk about how all the pharmaceutical companies are moving their operations to India. What do we do about this?
Well, we can't do anything about what India or China do, but we can do something about what we do. We're chasing a lot of businesses off our shores with, again, an unbalanced regulatory environment and unbalanced litigation.
India has a heavily regulate the pharmaceutical industry domestically. What we're talking about here is cheap labor.
No, I think what we're talking about is business people deciding, making decisions, where will I locate my work? And I'm going to do that where I'm treated in a reasonable fashion. And right now the U.S. is losing on that because we've turned over a lot of our regulation to the trial lawyers, and we turned over a lot of it to excessive government regulation.
Well, this article is suggesting that that's got nothing to do with it. It has to do with the cost of labor. As big drug companies shut down research facilities in the U.S. and other rich countries, labs in India and China are increasingly picking up the slack. Eli Lilly and Company, Wyeth, GlaxoSmithKline have all outsourced chemistry work to Indian firms. Novartis announced that last month they're moving 400 scientists to China. Bayer said it's closing major research facilities in the U.S. Scientists at Adventis say that while they earn a bit less than they would at U.S. drug companies, India's cost of living is cheaper.
Well, that's a big part of it. Obviously, cost of living is a big part of it. The availability of labor is a big part of it. But when you're a businessman, Tom, you make your decisions not just based on labor. Certainly, that's a big part of it. But you also base it on the regulatory environment, your cost of doing business from the standpoint of taxes and real estate taxes.
Shouldn't we be doing something
about
to keep these companies?
I talked about getting rid of our tax system here in, Tom, in America, getting rid of the income tax, going to a national sales tax, a fair tax, something that doesn't put such a huge burden on people to comply with, and I think we'd get some of this business to return, and we'd prevent a lot of people from leaving the country.
So we go to a national sales tax, so people who spend 100% of their income are going to be taxed on 100% of their income, whereas somebody like Bill Gates, who probably spends 1% of his income, is only going to be taxed on 1% of his income.
Tom, every consumption tax plan has huge subsidies and huge rebates for the working poor. So the working poor and people
if they figure out how to fill out the paperwork, they get the tax back. Come on.
They would get the tax back.
This is like trying to get VAT out of, you know, when you're leaving a European country, trying to get your VAT back.
No. This is a monthly check that comes directly out of the government like clockwork for everybody in the country.
We have to wrap this up, John, and I want to bring it back to health care, and we've only got 40 seconds left. We're talking with John Cox, Cox2008.com. National health care, yes or no?
No, well, I don't want my doctor working for the government. I want more doctors. You want to bring down the cost of
How about just doing away with all the health insurance companies and having Medicare for all?
You want to bring down the cost of health insurance. You want to bring down the cost. Increase competition, Tom. I hate to sound like a broken record on that, but competition is what improves quality.
So we need more insurance companies.
We need more insurance companies. We need more doctors. We need more nurses. We need more surgery centers. We need more availability. And we need consumers to have choices, because when consumers have choices, they will do their own shopping and bring down the cost.
So the insurance companies right now are sucking 20-30% of all the health care dollars out. You want them to suck out more?
I want people to have choices. I want more competition. That'll bring down the cost. That'll make the system more efficient. That'll make the system more quality-oriented.
Okay. John Cox, Republican presidential candidate, 2008, cox2008.com. John, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
You've got a headache. Not got some strange disease, don't worry about it. This pill will set your mind at ease. It's called Progenitorivox. It's made by Squab Merco. It's a life-enhancing miracle. But there are some things you should know.
It may cause agitation, palpitations, excessive salivation, constipation, male lactation, rust-colored urination, hallucinations, bad vibrations, mild electric shock sensations. But it's worth it for the drugs I need.
Yes. Indeed, we got the pill for you. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. You know, what can I say? At one time we talked about this being the vast liberal conspiracy. I got to tell you, I will be the first to say I am a progressive, I am a liberal, I am proud of those labels, and I don't think that the values that are represented by the labels progressive and liberal are left. I keep meaning to write an op-ed piece about this. This is just what we have in the United States is we have the vast middle. If you ask the majority of Americans, do you think that there should be a national health care program like 36 of the other 37 industrialized countries, they will say yes. Well over 80% of them. Yes, absolutely. Do you think that we should have environmental protections, even if it means that our products cost a little bit more, so that we have a clean environment? Less gas. The vast majority of Americans, yes. Do you think that we should have a progressive taxation plan? Yes. Do you think the corporations should pay their fair share of the cost of maintaining the commons? The vast majority of people say yes. Do you think that we should have strong limits on lobbying and corporate participation in politics? The vast majority of Americans would say yes. Do you think, you just go right on down the list. The vast majority of Americans are communitarians. They believe that we're all in this together, that we are a community here in the United States. This is the core of the liberal worldview as articulated by liberals like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. As opposed to the conservative worldview articulated by John Adams and Sir Edmund Burke back in the 1790s, all the way up to today with Russell Kirk and William F. Buckley and the whole crowd, Grover Norquist, who think, you know, hey, it's every man for himself. It's a jungle out there. That's the conservative worldview. And the vast majority of Americans are in with the liberal and progressive worldview. That's the middle. The left in America is dead. There is no left in America for all practical purposes. I had on this program last year, somebody kept, you know, people, I get conservatives going, you lefties this, you lefties that. I said, okay, I'm going to give you a lefty. And we had on the president of the Communist Party of the United States of America, CPUSA. Now, there actually was a left in the 20s and 30s in the United States. The Communist Party was actually quite active in the United States, and the socialists, the old-fashioned socialists. But between Joe McCarthy and Stalin's trashing the word, you know, communism and the failure of the Soviet Union, that left is gone. I mean, this guy comes on the program and he says, yeah, the government should buy, you know, should own all the factories. They should make all the pharmaceuticals. They should make our TV. I don't want the government making my shoes. I don't want the government making my TV. I don't want the government making my pharmaceuticals. I'm telling you, the left is dead in America. What we have is the all of us and this small band of right-wing, largely pro-corporate cranks who call themselves conservatives. And Big Pharma is, I mean, right in there with them. Kelly Hearn writing over at Alternate, a new surface report, newly surfaced report alleges that in the drug monolith Pfizer gave an unproven drug to Nigerian children and infants suffering from meningitis without the authorization of the Nigerian government. Some of the children in the trial died, others suffered brain damage. GlaxoSmithKline, Merck, and Wyeth currently conduct 30 to 50% of their experiments outside Western Europe and the United States and plan to boost foreign trials to 67% this year, according to USA Today. Why? Poor, desperate patients are willing to try anything. Another article by Russell Mokerberg and Robert Weissman over at CommonDreams.org. The United States permits pharmaceuticals to be marketed by unregulated monopolies. Patent protection gives the drug companies monopoly control over their products. They don't face direct competition, nor price controls. And yet every other country in the world is saying, hey, wait a minute. We're going to buy these things in bulk. We're going to, you know, we know what it costs you to make this. If you're going to operate as a monopoly, you know, like the power companies do in those places where you have private power companies, you say, you know, we know what your costs are. We're going to let you make a reasonable profit, but we're not going to let you gouge people. We're not going to let you rip people off. At a certain level, it's funny because John Cox, ironic perhaps is a better word, John Cox is an old-fashioned Republican. You know, he's a Teddy Roosevelt Republican. Well, Teddy Roosevelt was a progressive. And, you know, I guess in that regard, he and I agree. We should bring back the Sherman Antitrust Act. Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing that in 1982, which led to this wave of mergers and acquisitions, Michael Milken and his buddies and all these guys becoming billionaires. And now we have media companies owned by defense contractors like NBC and General Electric. And it's totally not good for America. We should bring back the Sherman Act. No president since Reagan has had the courage to do it. And frankly, I doubt we're going to get. Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens in 2008. But other than that, no, I'm not there with you, John. I'm sorry. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
Everybody's talking, no one says a word. Everybody's making love, no one really cares. There's Nazis in the bathroom, just below the stairs. All of something happening.
And welcome back to listener-supported radio. It's the Tom Hartman radio program supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors and our local stations. Let the local station know you're listening. Let your local sponsors in particular know that you're listening. And consider buying their products, particularly this time of year when a lot of product buying is going on. As well as our national sponsors, Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time. 1-800-425-2532, sacredgroundscoffee.com. Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now, 1-800-511-MAX, smalldog.com. And the Organic Wine Company, Eco Wine, 1-888-ECO-WINE and ecowine.com. 35 minutes past the hour. It's hard to get recent information because of increasing restrictions, the support of increasing restrictions by Republican administrations on corporations, basically keeping secrets, allowing corporations to keep secrets. But in 2001, U.S. drug companies spent 2.5 times more on marketing and advertising and administration than they did on research and development. That's pretty startling. Between 1997 and 2002, promotion to healthcare professionals in the U.S. doubled to $18.5 billion. Direct-to-consumer advertising added another $3 billion. In Australia, drug companies spend more than $660,000 a day on promotion, but that's only 1% of what they spend in the U.S. So that'd be, what, $660 million a day on promotion? In 1995, 25 companies controlled over half the global drug market. By 2000, just 15 managed to do the same thing. I don't have the statistics for right now. I would guess it's in the neighborhood of 10. Pharmaceuticals, the most profitable industry of all. More profitable than commercial banking, more profitable than oil, the most profitable of all. 1-866-440-8466. You can drop into our live chat room at TomHartmann.com, too, if you want to say hi to some of the finest minds on the entire Internet. Just go to TomHartmann.com and click live chat. It's right in the middle at the top of the page there. Glenn in Dallas, Texas, I'm assuming listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Glenn, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I'm glad to be on your show this time. I wanted to compliment you for being on there, but the Mr. Cox guy that you had on there, as you introduced him, I really had great admiration for him. But when he opened his mouth, he showed me that he was a true Republican, the same kind of Republican that George W. Bush is. First off, I don't agree with what he said about trial lawyers. I don't agree about us not having a national pharmaceutical insurance for all Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And my thing is, what's wrong with having a national insurance?
Here's what's wrong with the national health care program, Glenn. Right now, if you spend $100 for health care through the Medicare system, which is a single-payer system, it costs about $3 to administer that. So $3 sticks to the fingers of the administrators of Medicare. It's a $3 overhead, 3% overhead. If you spend $100 on health care, now that's a single-payer system like they have, for example, in Switzerland or in Germany. If you spend $100 for health care through the Veterans Administration, which is socialized medicine like they have more or less in England, where the doctors actually work for the government, the Veterans Administration, and the hospitals are owned by the government, it costs about $3.50, about 3.5%. So roughly 3 to 4% is the cost of administration. That's the money to be made, as it were, to have a health insurance program that's either a single-payer program or that is a socialized medicine program. Right now, however, if you spend $100 through most of the health insurance companies in the United States, anywhere from $15 to $30 sticks to their fingers because they got to pay their CEOs their multi-million dollar salaries. In the case of one of them, a $2 billion salary last year. William McGuire at United Health made $1.78 trillion plus more, you know, over $1,000 million in 1 year. Right? You've got to pay the CEOs of the salaries. You've got to pay dividends to the stockholders. You've got to pay for the gold-plated faucets on the bathrooms and the corporate jets. You got to pay for all the lobbyists. Yeah, I know. It is over the top, and that's why all these members of Congress, with the exception of Ron Wyden. Ron Wyden actually came out today and called for a national health care program. He still wants to keep the health insurance companies in the business. I talked to him about it on the phone this morning, and he said, well, you know, it's just politically impossible to kill them off. I mean, you just can't do it. You've got to bring them in at least over the short term. And so, you know, he and I somewhat part company on that. I think we just need to go straight to a single-payer health insurance program. Medicare for all. Make it really easy. Just say every person in America is now enrolled in Medicare, period. It would lower the risk. It would lower the cost. Right now, our cost of health care, we've got these insurance companies sucking 20 to 30% of all health care dollars out and fattening themselves and making huge profits and creating millionaires and billionaires in that industry. Bill Frist's daddy is one of the 50 richest men in America. Why? Because of the private health industry. You know, he was buying hospitals and flipping them private and bleeding people dry. That's what's stopping it, Glenn, and that's what we need to stop. We need to stop the insane privatization of health in the United States and say, listen, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, life, the first of those three phrases, life is something that is part of the commons. It is a right. It is not a privilege. Hank in Dora, Michigan. Hey, Hank, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, you took a little wind out of my sails there. Your guest is whining about the tax structure for these companies, yet he never mentioned the billions that Bill Frist has socked away from ripping off the American public.
Yeah, and Billy Towson, who pushed through the poison pill, you know, putting the pharmaceutical provision into Medicare, which, you know, in and of itself was a good idea, but then saying that the government can't negotiate for the cost of drugs. So the VA says to one of these big drug companies, okay, we're going to use 1 million tablets of penicillin this year. What's your price on 1 million tablets? And they say, penny apiece. Medicare says we're going to use 1 million tablets of penicillin this year. What's your price on one tablet? And the pharmaceutical company says, oh, one tablet, that's $1 apiece. And that's what we end up having to pay. I mean, you know, the conservatives allowed that to happen because they thought it would bring Medicare to its knees and they could kill off the national health care program that threatens the health insurance companies. Billy Towson was pushing it because pharma was going to make millions on hundreds of billions of dollars in profit, and they have, and they hired him at the $2 million a year salary out of Congress. He had to get a special exemption to leave Congress early and go to work as the head of pharma, the trade industry, you know, group for the big pharmaceutical companies. It's absolutely nuts. It's absolutely nuts. Hank, thanks for the call. Brian in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'd like to talk to you about my experience when it comes to the healthcare situation, especially when it comes to workman's comp and the limitation on people being able to sue the employer. And in my particular case, back in 1996, I had a piece of freight, and I'm a truck driver, fall on my neck. And ultimately, what happened is that I blew out three discs and fractured two vertebrae.
Ouch.
And what ultimately came about is the employer denied any workman's comp right up front.
Well, like this had nothing to do with your job?
They just literally denied it right up front that they had, you know, that there was a problem. But it was in California, and California limits you on what you can get in the way of, you know, a settlement through the workman's comp situation. Maximum is, if you die, is $250,000. In my situation.
This was one of Arnold's brilliant ideas, wasn't it?
Well, it was pre-Arnold, but it's something that they're in favor of. But, what ultimately ended up is they said that, gee, Brian, you're only 46% disabled. Don't ask me how you can say that, but that's what they did. And on a sliding scale, it was worth $56,000. And we negotiated out, you know, lifetime medical.
Incredible.
Well, that's all I got on the thing. Well,
That's for you to cover your medical expenses for the rest of your life. And I'm assuming that your medical expenses are going up and it's going to cost you more than that.
Right. And let me say the rest of it. For 6 years, they sat there and wouldn't even allow me to see specialists or anybody to fix my neck. And finally, at the end of a six-year period, I negotiated the thing out with them and was able to settle the entire thing for $50,000 and have them go away. But the problem was that when I finally got my neck surgery to repair all of this, now I have two steel rods that go straight up and down in my neck and three that go across, six screws in my neck, and that, you know, it's all fused together, it's one piece. That surgery was over $125,000.
And you had 50 grand from the settlement.
Yeah. Okay, and then on top of that, let me go back to the very beginning of this. When they denied me the ability to get workman's comp, they did this, and it held me up for 9.5 months. Well, you know what the foreclosure on your home is in California? If you don't pay after 3 months, guess what? And guess what happened to me and my family? We lost our house. We lost everything.
Man, I'm so sorry to hear that, Brian. You know, half of all bankruptcies in the United States are caused by medical emergencies.
Exactly.
Half of all bankruptcies in the United States. And then you get these bozos in Congress who say, oh, we need to tighten up the bankruptcy laws because people are taking advantage of it. I mean, it's give me a break. And a third of them are caused by divorce, mostly women who end up without the income of their husbands but still have half the bills. Brian, I got to move along, but thank you very much for the call and for sharing your story with us. It's good to hear from you, and I hope things get better for you. 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh. He'll want some. And doesn't lead to stiff thinking, by the way. We'll be right back. And welcome back, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Our telephone number, 866-440-THOM. Jonathan in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Jonathan?
Thank you. I'd like to make a couple of comments. Myself and a couple of guys are sitting around, and we were trying to remember when was it legal for pharmaceutical companies to market drugs that have to be prescribed by your doctor, because it seems when we were younger, we never saw these, you know, advertisements.
If right. It used to be against the law. And I frankly don't remember when that happened. It would have been somewhere between the tail end of the Reagan administration and the middle of the Clinton administration. With regard to big business and regulation thereof, basically Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, and Bush Jr. have all been on the same page. You know, they've with regard to multinational corporations and the drug companies and whatnot. I'm sorry, I don't remember the year that it happened, but you're right. For most of the history of the United States, pharmaceutical companies could not market prescription medications directly to consumers.
And I mean, billions of dollars are going to marketing these drugs.
That's
and I
right.
I mean, I'm a truck driver. I have no business going into my doctor's office and telling them to prescribe this drug over that drug just because I saw it on a television commercial.
I know, and they are spending 2.5 times as much money marketing those drugs to you as they are on research and development for new drugs. And on the R&D that they're doing on new drugs, first of all, a majority of it is paid for by the federal government for actual real new drugs, and a large chunk of what they're spending on R&D internally that the pharmaceutical companies are doing is not to actually develop a new drug. It's to tweak an existing drug that's about to go generic so that they can come out with a new patent medicine that they can sell for at $5 a pill rather than 20 cents a pill. It's nuts. Jonathan, thanks for the call and for the you know, pointing that out. It was a good point you make. Keith in Huntington Beach, California. Hey, Keith, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Great. What's up?
Hey, I just wanted to kind of, I think it's interesting that hypocrisy, the people that are actually crying for deregulation most of all are the ones to cry to Big Brother, you know, when it comes to corporate welfare or whatever.
Yeah, they don't want corporations paying taxes. They do want corporations being subsidized with things like the oil depletion allowance, but they sure don't want we the people to be protected.
Exactly. And, I mean, just one example, the drug company is just a blatant example of it, but as far as, like, them saying, well, no, you know, you're not allowed to get drugs from Canada from those same companies, you know, and yet they're the ones that are always crying about, well, no, you know, we don't want interference from government. Of course, like you said, the research is paid for by grants to universities and stuff.
Yep.
It's amazing. I always, anyone that cries over, you know, that we've lost the definition of what a free market is anymore. Free market to these people are complete protectionism for them.
Yeah.
You know, and
they're monopoly markets. I mean, that's the end result of absolutely unregulated, raw, naked, laissez-faire capitalism is predatory markets. What you end up with is the big fish eat the little fish, and then they eat the middle-sized fish, and there's nothing left with big fish. And that's why Franklin Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself by saying, wait a minute, we're going to make sure that there's space for the middle fish, the middle-sized fish, and the little fish in the marketplace, and brought it back, you know, turned us back from the era of the robber barons and helped build an America that was filled with the small businesses. You know, the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, you could drive across America, you could go to a shopping mall, and every business was locally owned, or the vast majority of them. They were all different. They reflected the local character of the communities. Ever since Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and started rolling back Roosevelt's reforms, what we see now is you could drop, you know, jump out of an airplane with a parachute into any city in America and not have any idea where you are. You could wander around that city for days and still not have any idea where you are, because every restaurant is the same everywhere in the country. Every hotel is the same everywhere in the country. You know, it just goes on and on and on. And there's something fundamentally wrong with that. Keith, thanks for the call. Good point. Steve in Dower, Texas. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. Listen, very quickly, your caller today and your caller yesterday, they both have a common theme, a common argument that they're making. The first one today is that in a free market, it presumes that that businesses will behave in an ethical, responsible manner in pursuit of profit.
Right.
It compares to the guy yesterday who was saying that individuals in an unregulated would behave in an ethical, responsible, and rational manner.
Right.
If we were just able to explain everything.
And that's right. This is a utopian concept that Ayn Rand brought in and
Absolutely.
Has been glommed onto by the right-wingers to justify basically greed.
Exactly. That was my point. Thank
yeah.
you for
okay.
my call.
Yeah. Well said, Steve. Thank you very much for the call. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick.
Good day, Tom. I just wanted to kind of go back to what you were saying earlier about the far left, or maybe just the left. And you actually cited the Communist Party, you know. And I read, I actually subscribe to their theoretical journal. And the thing of it is, when you hear, and I want to mention the talk show host's name, but certain right-wingers, maybe they all do, they talk about organizations like MoveOn.org. They talk about Paul Krugman, who I guess writes for the New York Times, is a far-left bomb thrower.
Yeah.
Well, trust me, folks out there listening, and I know you probably know this, Tom, but the real far left are these groups like the Workers' World Party, Progressive Labor Party, Revolutionary Communist Party.
Yeah, that's, and they're fairly marginalized. I mean,
exactly.
In fact, one of the folks in the chat room, I think it was, I forget which person it was, but one of the folks in the chat room just a few minutes ago said, you know, wait a minute, I kind of like FDR. I think I'm the far left. And I said, FDR got elected four times as President of the United States by the majority of the people. FDR wasn't the left. FDR was the middle. The proof of it is that the majority of America was right there with him. Left and right in indicate or imply some kinds of fringe, and you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, and the far left is out there, and it's not Paul Krugman, and it's not Move On, and it's not anything that you're going to hear on the radio. And the far right is out there, and oddly, they're all over TV, they're all over radio, and they've taken control of a good chunk of the Republican Party. And it's a really scary thing. It's time for America to turn back toward the middle and turn back to the ideals this country was founded on. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Our quote for the day from Edward R. Murrow. We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. When the loyal opposition dies, I think the soul of America dies with it. Edward R. Murrow, our quote for the day. This from the wire services. One day after hosting an international conference devoted to denying that the Holocaust ever happened, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad made headlines again today by holding another conference to deny that the earlier conference ever happened. President Ahmadinejad's Holocaust Denial Conference was a page one story in newspapers around the world this week, making some observers wonder why the Iranian leader would hold another conference attempting to deny that the earlier conference had occurred. But in Tehran today, President Ahmadinejad welcomed delegates from around the world, proclaiming the first annual conference of Holocaust denial deniers will now come to order. The president of Iran then launched into a blistering 45-minute speech denying the existence of the other conference, at which he reportedly gave a blistering 45-minute speech. Mr. Ahmadinejad asked the delegates, "Do people honestly believe that I hosted a Holocaust denial conference? Next thing you know, they'll be claiming I'm developing nuclear weapons." Present at the Conference of Holocaust Denial Deniers was former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke, who vehemently denied ever having attended an earlier meeting. "I could not possibly have attended the meeting because the meeting did not happen," Mr. Duke told a reporter. "Plus, I don't exist." At the conclusion of the Holocaust Denial Deniers Conference, Mr. Ahmadinejad embarked on a tour to promote a new book about his hypothetical hosting of a Holocaust Denial Conference entitled, "If I Did It." Yeah. Well, that's from Andy Borowitz, with permission. BorowitzReport.com is website. And, you know, it's funny. Right, that Ahmadinejad would be denying that he denied, and blah, blah, blah. Here's where the story gets real, though. The Oregonian, the newspaper, the statewide newspaper published out of Portland in the state where I live, either yesterday or the day before, did a full page, devoted an entire page, which is no small thing in a newspaper, a full newspaper page, top to bottom, left to right, on the history of the Holocaust, complete with photos from the liberated camps, the names of the death camps and where they were located, the difference between the death camps and the concentration camps, the timeline, the chronology, who was killed where. Now, that's not to say that, gee, isn't it great that Ahmadinejad
is has hosted this Holocaust denial conference because it's causing an increased awareness in countries like the United States about the reality of the Holocaust. Although that does seem to be kind of the good fallout of it. The point that everybody is missing, all the commentators in this, or frankly, I would say the point that those on the right are deliberately ignoring. And this is what, frankly, concerns me so much about the way that this is being covered. Those on the right who think that we should begin a war against Iran and are always looking for a reason to start a war against Iran, the point that they're not talking about, the point that they will not share with you, is that what Ahmadinejad is saying in public is what probably the vast majority, certainly majority, probably the vast majority of the average man on the street and woman on the street across much of the Middle East actually believe to be the truth. I have worked in the Middle East. I've traveled throughout the Middle East in a variety of countries. And just, you know, from personal experience, I can tell you, you walk up to somebody on the street in Saudi Arabia. You walk up to somebody on the street in Jordan. You walk up to somebody in the street in Syria, in Egypt. And you say, hey, you think that Holocaust really happened? You think Hitler actually killed all those Jews? And they'll say, no. Come on, are you kidding? That's something that, the Jewish producers of the Hollywood movies made up. That's the majority of the Arab world believes that. And, I'm it's not politically correct to say that. But I'm not quoting any survey here. Although, I don't know, maybe David should be Googling for one right now. Just so I'm not hanging out here in the wind all by myself. But I'm telling you this just from my personal experience of having, you know, over the last 25, 30 years, spent a lot of time in the Middle East. And, you know, so the point is, the way the coverage should be in the United States should be that the Saudis, in their textbooks, talk about god-awful things, about largely about the Jews, but also about other religions as well. Promulgate mythologies, highly destructive mythologies, and stories, not just about Israel, but about Jewish people broadly. That Wahhabism is grounded solidly in an entire anti-Semitic body of conventional wisdom, all of which is wrong. And the difference between Saudi Arabia and Iran right now with regard to the Holocaust is that the Saudis are funding this thing. The Saudis are cranking this out. The Saudis are promoting it quietly. It's not even, you know, some sort of big national, let's have a convention kind of thing. And the Iranians, you know, Ahmadinejad is just talking out loud about it. Now, he's a fool for doing it. It's going to backfire on him around the world, but in the area, keep in mind who his market is. Ahmadinejad is a small-town politician, a local politician, well, he's a small-town, Tehran, he was the mayor of Tehran. It's not a small town, but he's a local politician. He's hustling for support in the Arab world. And so, of course, he's going to promote this kind of nonsense. He's going to be hustling these kinds of stories. But the fact of the matter is that the right in the United States is now using this, and this is what we should be worried about, frankly. The right in the United States is using Ahmadinejad's having this, what we look at as a stupid conference, as a way of solidifying his political support across the Middle East. This is what Saudi Arabia is, you know, he's beating the Saudis at their own game, and they're very concerned about it. The reason Saudi Arabia said to Dick Cheney, you will come now. It's because they are worried about a Sunni takeover of Iraq. Excuse me, a Shia takeover of Iraq. The Iran is Shia. The majority of Iraq is Shia. And the majority of people in Saudi Arabia are Shia, but the ruling family is Sunni. In Saudi Arabia, the ruling family is Sunni, just like Saddam Hussein, who ruled Iraq, is Sunni. And here you have Sunni minorities ruling Shia majorities. And the royal family is scared to death that they are going to be overthrown by the street. And so, you know, you had this piece in the Washington Post, for example, back on November 29th by Nawaf Obaid. He says, on February 2003, this is a counselor to the Saudi government, later fired apparently for writing this, but nonetheless, he's speaking the truth, in my opinion. He says, in February 2001, a month before the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, the Saudi foreign minister, Prince Saud al-Faisal, warned President Bush that he would be solving one problem and creating five more if he removed Saddam Hussein by force. Had Bush heeded his advice, Iraq would not now be on the brink of a full-blown civil war and disintegration. The Saudis are afraid of an independent Shia-run Iraq, and they are going to force us to stay there. That was the message to Cheney. You're not going to pull out of that country. What do you think? Are you crazy? It's not even about defending oil. It's about defending the Saudi royal family, which has long ties to the Bush royal family. So anyhow, the point that I want to make is that if don't go down that road that the right-wingers are going down of, oh, look at this, Ahmadinejad held this conference. That proves he's a bad guy. Why don't we just blow him up? That is a worldview which is shared right across the Middle East, and somebody needs to say it. And I guess I just did. Hey, time now for our progressive pop quiz. Our question for the day, and it's wrong, of course. Which U.S. That worldview. Our question for the day, which U.S. senator has a new health care plan that would provide coverage for all Americans? Sixth caller with the correct answer, 1-866-440-THOM. Gets a copy of my new book, Screwed.
If you wasn't listening, that's a problem anyway. Are you searching under every stone and alone? Nearly in a prison chain like a dog. Never saw the weapon, that's what the experts say. Sometimes a bad one, that's a fact. Getting more like him, but old Crock than that. Rummy's ditch, so is death.
You know, in the Middle Ages, when people were convinced there were witches, and then they looked for them, they thought they found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence, and I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
Yes, that Hans Blix. Yeah, there he is. There are no weapons of mass destruction. That before the invasion. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth in broadcasting for a change in America. 22 minutes past the hour. Oh, I think I already said that, didn't I? We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz. Our question again, which U.S. senator has just introduced a new health care plan that would provide coverage for all Americans? And congratulations to Vincent Moulier in Eugene, Oregon, listening on KOPT. Hey, good on you, Vincent. He knew that the correct answer is Senator Ron Wyden. And we'll see if this thing gets traction. It's a good start. It's a real good start, what Ron Wyden is introducing. It's not, you know, it's not what I would do if I could do it tomorrow. I would say Medicare for all. I'd do instant single-payer health care. But I realize that, you know, I'm not a U.S. senator, and I don't have to deal with the political realities. I can just, you know, tell you what I'm thinking here. So, anyhow. Speaking of the denial of the Holocaust all across the Middle East, for example, this is from Sechma Dolvid, an Israeli website. In an interview with BBC News on August 10th, Mohammed Salmawi, editor of the Egyptian newspaper Al-Aram Hedbo, And Mohammed Khalil, one of the newspaper correspondents, quote, repeated denial of the Holocaust. Khalil said that, quote, only 500,000 Jews were murdered in the Holocaust, end quote. Article on November 17th, 2003, issued the Egyptian newspaper Al-Osba, essentially the same thing. Palestinian Authority, I mean, yeah, they by and large turned this into almost a tenet of faith, for some time, tragically. Syria. During October, November of 2003, Al-Manar Television in Lebanon broadcast a 29-part series, Survey of Jewish History, denying the Holocaust. United Arab Emirates, they have a think tank, or they had, actually. It got brought down by, got brought down by a woman, Rachel Fish, here in the United States, who launched a campaign against Harvard University, getting a $2.5 million gift from these guys. An Arab League-sponsored think tank that was based out of the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. It's called the Zayed Center for Coordination and Follow-Up. What was it? It was, denying the Holocaust. I mean, as I said, this is not unique to Iran. And Americans need to know that. Americans need to know that mythology is widespread across the Middle East. And frankly, if we had any sense about us, we would use Ahmadinejad's conference as an opportunity to start busting up that mythology in the Middle East and pointing out the reality of the Holocaust. But instead, the blowhards, the right-wing blowhards in the United States are using Ahmadinejad's conference instead as an opportunity to vilify Iran broadly and call for war with Iran. And turn him into a cartoon character. When there's really some complexity here, when you not about the Holocaust, but about the whole issue of who Ahmadinejad is, what he's doing in Iran, and why Iran is fighting a proxy war with Syria, Saudi Arabia, or really with the Saudi royal family, which is a minority in Saudi Arabia, the Sunni Saudi royal family. Why they're fighting this proxy war over Iraq. And why the Saudis have dragged us into this thing. And they're saying to Bush and a bunch of them, Bush, Wolfowitz, Cheney, Pearl, Feith, Rumsfeld, a whole bunch of them, they're saying, okay, you guys, we had a Sunni in there who, Rumsfeld, you shook his hand, our guy Ronald Reagan sold him weapons, our guy George Bush Sr. sold him weapons. We had a good Sunni in there who was keeping down the Shia. His name was Saddam Hussein, and you've knocked him over. Now you better get another Sunni in there, or we're gonna do something really nasty. And I mean, keep in mind, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis. This is, I'm not trying to get into Saudi bashing them. It's not like all things Saudi Arabia are bad, but the fact of the matter is that Saudi Arabia is not a democracy. You have essentially two real democracies in that region. You have Israel and you have Palestine. And arguably, the current Iraqi government, and we can, debate whether or not it's a democracy, but it's not what Saudi Arabia wants. It's not what any of the countries in that region want. Is a democracy in that area. Because now it's going to put the Saudi royal family at risk. The Saudi royal family is looking at the possibility that they may have an uprising that could bring them down. And they're going to use us to prevent that from happening. Take your calls after the break. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
Oh, Sergeant, I'm a crafty and I've just arrived in camp. I've come to wear the uniform and join the martial tramp. And I want to do my duty, but one thing I do implore. You must give me lessons, Sergeant, for I've never killed before. To do my job obediently is all that I desire. To learn my weapon thoroughly and how to aim and fire. To learn to kill the enemy and then to slaughter more. Oh, I'll need instruction, Sergeant, for I've never killed before.
And welcome back to the Democracy Zone, the real free speech zone. No barbed wire, no White House passes required. We won't drag you off if you have a no blood for oil bumper sticker on your car. Welcome back to the program. Lawdyke in the chat room says, Tom, would you please discuss the difference between the Shia and the Sunnis? Let me make an analogy to Christianity, because I suspect that most people have some knowledge of Christianity, at least in the United States, regardless of your religion. The early Christian church is referred to very often by biblical scholars as the Jerusalem church. It was Jesus and his followers, the official 12 disciples and Mary Magdalene and Mary, and I mean, there were a few others. And it was led by Peter. Jesus put Peter in charge of that group. And then there was another group that emerged some years after Jesus had been crucified. And it was led by a guy who was born a Roman, who had converted to Judaism, and who had spent most of his life killing Jewish followers of Jesus, and had this experience on the road to Damascus where he was knocked off his donkey and to the ground, or on the road to Ephesus, whatever it was. It was the road to Damascus, as I recall. And his name was Paul, originally Saul, changed his name to Paul. Or it's the Greek version of it is Paul. And he basically became the evangelist who took over Christianity. And Paul and Peter was the original church. He was the original disciple of Jesus. Paul and Peter didn't get along all that well. And the Jerusalem church, the Peter church, the Jesus, Peter, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John bunch, the original disciple, that church, the Jerusalem church, essentially died out within a few hundred years. Arguably within the first 100 years. And the Pauline church, the church that Paul founded, became today's modern Christianity. Became the Catholic church, and then, there were a couple of splits off that. Martin Luther split off, and the King Henry VIII split off, and the Protestants, split off from the Catholics. And of course, you've got also the Orthodox churches. Some of the Orthodox churches, actually, the Coptics, for example, the Egyptian Orthodox Church, claims that they were started, that they're the actual living descendants of the original Jerusalem Church, that they are the, that they were started by one of the original disciples. So imagine if to this day there were still these two Christian churches, the original followers of Jesus and their lineage, or if Jesus had had children, his children and their lineage. In other words, some sort of an inherited direct lineage versus a kind of right-hand man lineage, Paul's church. Well, that's kind of how it is with the Shia and the Sunni. And this is a very imperfect analogy or metaphor. And probably some Islamic scholar will call right now and correct me in 16 different ways, and that's fine. This is my clumsy understanding of it. The Shia wanted to follow the son of Muhammad. But the caliphate at the time, after Muhammad died or was assassinated, the caliphate or leaped into heaven, depending on which story you take, the caliphs assassinated a series of his ancestors and sort of ended up with a cousin. But the Shia are basically saying, let's follow the direct blood lineage of Muhammad. The Sunnis are following the equivalent of Paul. They're following their most elder prophet was Muhammad's right-hand guy. And both of them, claim to be the original, we can trace our all the way back to Muhammad in 630, whatever it was, 632 or something like that. So as I said, it's a very imperfect end. But what's significant today, I suppose, is that in Saudi Arabia you have the Sunni royal family, and in the neighborhood of half. I talked with Dar Jamal about this morning. He said that in his opinion, more than half of Saudi Arabia, the poor people, many of them are not, don't have legal citizenship, are Shia. In Saudi Arabia, some sources say Saudi Arabia's majority Sunni, but the ruling party is Sunni. The majority of Iraq is Shia, but the ruling party traditionally has been Sunni,
as was Saddam Hussein. And in Iran, the majority are Shia, and the ruling group is Shia. So they're thus the mess. And then you've got, you know, Jordan and Syria and all these other, you know, all these mixtures and all these battles going on. Anyhow, 1-866-440-8466. Bonnie in Sacramento, California, listening on KSAC. Hey, Bonnie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was just wondering that if they're always denying that 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust, but what about they seem to have forgotten the 6 million non-Jews who died during the Holocaust?
The labor unionists, the gays, the Catholics, the communists, the early opponents of Hitler.
Yes.
So
do they deny that also, or is it only that Jews?
I don't, you know,
the Holocaust not exist?
I have to confess, Bonnie, I have not ever seriously studied the literature of the Holocaust deniers, so I don't know. I don't know what they're specifically denying. I know that the year that I lived in Germany, I met more than a few Germans who thought that who were in the Holocaust denying camp, shall we put it, that just didn't want to acknowledge that. And that always shocked me. They were always very elderly people. I never met anybody under 60 or 70 who would fall into that category. But there were some old folks there who thought that the biggest mistake Hitler made was invading Russia a year too early, which, you know, was pretty horrific. But I think I know that mindset in Germany is dying out very rapidly. And across Europe, it's just, you know, and it's a very, very tiny minority. And across Europe, it's a very, very tiny minority. But I believe personally, my own experience, I believe that it's a majority worldview in the Arab Middle East, and something that, you know, that we should acknowledge. So, Bonnie, thanks for the call. I'm sorry I didn't have the exact answer for you. Jay in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I want to talk to you about the medical insurance thing.
Yeah, the argument in the first hour is whether or not we should have single-payer health care.
Well, I've been a practicing physician for 30 years, and I remember the days when health insurance was nonprofit. And I agree something is obscene when insurance companies rip off billions of dollars and stick it in their pockets. But I don't think single-payer is the answer, just like I don't think monopoly is good in any other business. And I'd like to just kind of share an idea that came from one of the local physicians here.
Okay.
What he suggests was open Medicare to everybody. That is, anybody who wants to get into Medicare could buy in, pay whatever it costs for the coverage.
Right.
And then the private insurance company would have to offer the very same coverage, and they could set the price wherever they want to. And this way, if, as the business folk always say, well, we're more efficient than government, then the prices would be better. And if they were not as good, they would just fade away.
You're right. Yeah, that's a good idea. That's an excellent idea. And I don't disagree with it, because the fact of the matter is that government – but see, they'd figure out a way to sabotage it. I mean, it's because government doesn't have the overhead that private industry has. I mean, they don't have to pay huge CEO salaries, and they don't have to pay for marketing and advertising, and they don't have to, you know, so they would figure out a way to sabotage it. It's like power, you know. Power utilities are natural monopolies, and they represent something that, like healthcare, is essential to life. And by and large, I mean, there's a few folks who live off the grid, but
right.
and you have, I mean, here in the Northwest, in the Pacific Northwest, we've seen these huge battles, you know, Enron coming in, and in California as well, privatizing what used to be public power entities and jacking up the rates and sucking out the profits, and or figuring out ways to stick it to the public power entities and bring them down. If it could be done, you know, in an honest way, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, I think you need competition, though, somehow. Because if the government has the only show in town and you don't like their policies, if they, for instance, say, okay, next year anybody over 70 doesn't get a coronary bypass procedure, there's nothing you can do. You're toast.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so having multiple players in the field,
right.
Good point. Good point, Jay. May I steal your idea?
Please. It's actually not mine, as long as a guy named David Gans.
Okay, great. I will officially take that position henceforth and forevermore. I think it's quite reasonable.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Cliff in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Cliff, we have a minute before I have to take a break. What's up?
Hey, you know, I just wanted to weigh in on the same issue about, you know, Tom, thanks for having this forum. But the thing is we're not going to be able to change America, and the pervasive undercurrent of our greed and our greed-run bureaucracy until we address the problem of the special interest groups and the lobbyists. We need some reform there. Everything else that we talk about is not superfluous, but we have to get to the underlying problem. The underlying problem is what do we do about, like, President Clinton got elected on the platform that he was going to make a national health care. And
right.
What happened to him?
He ran as a progressive and he governed as a conservative, basically.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what we have to do is look to our past and to know what our future is going to be.
Yeah.
And
go ahead.
What's that?
Wrap it up, Cliff.
Oh, you know, I mean, just the other thing, you know, like Jimmy Carter. He wanted to get us free from independent from foreign oil.
Yeah, and Ronald Reagan ate his lunch on that one. Yeah, let me talk about that when we come back from the break. Good point you raised, and I appreciate the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
No, baby, no, don't lie.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy in the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you 9 minutes before the hour, or coming up on it. Anyway, we'll be shortly. Welcome back to the program. 1-866-440-8466. Jason in Temecula, California. Am I pronouncing that right?
It would be Temecula, California.
Temecula, actually. Thank you.
I've called in before, a long time ago, though. I know you were soliciting someone who's an Islamic scholar. I'm not quite anywhere close to that, but I do have some background information for you.
Okay.
You are correct about the split being over who would take over from Muhammad when he did die. The thing I wanted to add into this discussion about Islam that people may not know is those surrounding Muhammad, including his wives, had actually a lot of influence over some decisions he made. So women actually in Islam in the early days had a lot more influence than they do now,
mm-hmm.
Which is definitely good.
As is typical among tribal and nomadic societies.
Exactly.
As was the characteristic of Islam at the time.
And somehow it changed from that where men took over, and that's more locality-type changes of the religion.
Mm-hmm.
The other part that most people probably don't know is there's been surveys done recently that I had, and in the Middle East politics class that I've had recently, and basically at the lowest point, about 50% of those in the Arab world actually prefer democracy to dictatorship.
Sure.
As it comes out, but yeah, the reason why they're reluctant is the democracy that the United States has created, like Vietnam, we tried to do stuff with that, but it didn't really come out well. But they do admire us for having democracy.
Yeah, yeah, you're absolutely right. Do you agree with my argument that Ahmadinejad and Iran represent not the aberration but the norm across much of the Arab Middle East in terms of Holocaust denial?
Yeah, it's pretty much there mainly because we put so much stock in Israel. We still give them reparations from the Holocaust.
Yeah.
So they think we're kind of directly tied to them, so they don't really take much stock in it.
It's part
now,
of the, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's part of the broad anti-Israel thing. Jason, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the heads up. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you.
Ryan
in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Ryan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I hear you using the term insourcing as like Toyota coming to America and hiring American workers.
Well, that's how the Wall Street Journal uses the phrase.
Right. I disagree with that. That is foreign investment. When a company
I agree.
States, okay,
I agree with you.
The United States outsources, they send manufacturing to China to bring it back to serve the domestic market.
That's
insourcing
right.
doesn't exist, and I wish
yep.
that we would have that argument correctly.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you, Ryan, and that's why I say what's going on is that there are folks out there saying, isn't it a wonderful thing that foreign companies are coming over and buying, or foreign companies, yeah, are coming over and buying our companies or buying our land and building factories on our land to employ us, and they call that insourcing. This is the Thomas Friedman, the flat earth bunch, the whole, you know, globalization is wonderful bunch, and they've invented this word insourcing, and you're right, it's direct foreign investment into the United States. It's colonization of the United States. It's a form of reverse colonialism, or it's not even reverse from their point of view.
I agree. Hey, I have a real quick question for you.
Sure.
I was looking at the Ayn Rand website last night, and this is going to be a really dumb question, but was Ayn Rand a woman?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes,
so
she was.
They based their whole philosophy off the writings of a woman, even though they really don't want women's rights?
Well, I'm not sure that the Ayn Rand folks, the objectivists, don't want women's rights. I think they're very egalitarian about that. Yeah, but Ayn Rand was a woman. She was an atheist. She advocated rather libertine sexuality. Alan Greenspan, in fact, was initiated into her, I would call it a cult. They would not. Into her apartment in New York City in the late 1950s, early 1960s. She was a big deal. She was a big deal before she died. Yeah.
So. Okay, thanks, Tom.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot, Ryan. Good to hear from you. And 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Ahmed in Los Angeles, California. Hey, you want to set me straight on something here?
Yes. I think the issue with the Sunni population in Saudi Arabia, they are the majority.
Are you sure that they are the numeric majority? I talked with Dar Jamil about this morning, who has spent a lot of time in that region reporting on it. And his point was that what the Saudi royal family is afraid of is that they, being Sunni, represent that there's a Sunni minority, there's a Shia majority, and the Shia majority is largely disenfranchised, that many of them don't even have the rights of citizenship. And so, you know, you could technically say the majority of the citizens of Saudi Arabia are Sunni, but the numeric majority of people in Saudi Arabia is Shia. Was he wrong?
No, this is absolutely wrong. The majority of the people in Saudi Arabia are Sunni.
Mm-hmm.
There is a sizable Shia minority, which is probably 10 to 15%, I think.
Okay.
And they are disenfranchised. That's correct. They, you know.
And the royal family is very worried about them.
Oh, of course, absolutely. But the contention that Saudi Arabia is majority Shia is just flat out wrong.
Okay. Well, Ahmed, thank you for setting me straight.
But one more thing.
Yeah.
The other thing is the difference between the Sunni and the Shia is this really one basic difference, and that is when Muhammad died, there was a section of the Islamic people who wanted a democratically elected Khalifa, and the Shia wanted his nephew Ali to be the...
Okay, so the Sunnis were in favor of democracy, and the Shia wanted the lineage. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Yes, well, the old blogosphere, it's getting weirder and weirder as time goes on, and therefore time now for our...
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
Yep, Tom DeLay. His blog. Over at his blog, he publishes this trashing Arianna Huffington. And he says, Arianna Huffington, the long-lost fourth Gabor sister, is in quite a tizzy today. Apparently, she's acquired sound intel that there are actual Christians within the Defense Department. And then they go off on this rant about and against Arianna Huffington and so forth. And Arianna replies... Rather restrained fashion, actually, I'd say. She says, Dear Tom, first let me say welcome to the blogosphere. Always nice to have a new voice in the mix. So good to know that you have access to a computer in jail. Oh, sorry, you dodged that bullet. But since you're a newbie blogger, I want to give you a hand by pointing out some rookie mistakes you made in a diatribe about me. For starters, you seem to have missed the class on the difference between linking to a news story and offering an opinion on said news story. You claim that I was in quite a tizzy and that I acquired sound intel. Acquired sound intel? It sounds so cloak and danger. Anyhow, she goes on and she says, we linked to the story and headlined it, Senior Officers Accused of Coercing Soldiers to Adopt Evangelical Christianity. If you read the story, it's precisely what happened. You see, we don't make up the news. You're thinking of Fox. Yeah. Tom DeLay and his wonderful new blog, Tom DeLay Discovers the Internet. And those of you who been a while, I think it was it yesterday, the day before, who listen regularly, we read some of the pieces from Tom DeLay's blog. It was
really rather tragic. Yesterday it was, David says, the first 75 minutes in which basically, you know, before he got control of it, everybody was coming and going, Tom DeLay, you cretin, how dare you? Like that. It was very interesting. The situation in Iraq is continuing to deteriorate. And, in fact, actually, let's first take a look at what's going on with the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq and the civil war that we have sparked therein.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
Following our security and other developments in Iraq as of 7:25 Greenwich Mean Time today, Thursday. This from Reuters. In the city of Al-Lij, police found the bodies of two people shot and tortured in that village 20 miles south of Baghdad. In Mosul, a hospital received the bodies of five people. In Kirkuk, a policeman was killed and three others wounded when they tried to defuse a car bomb. In Baghdad, a car bomb killed an explosives expert and his assistant as they were trying to dismantle it on Wednesday night in Sadr City. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal, the politics and economics column in today's Wall Street Journal by John Harwood, noted conservative. A new Wall Street Journal NBC poll shows Americans have grown more pessimistic after the Iraq Study Group report that the situation there has become, quote, dire, end quote. That contributed to Mr. Bush's lowest ever approval rating in the Journal NBC poll, 34%, and turned Americans toward his Democratic adversaries. By 59 to 21%, Americans say Congress, rather than Mr. Bush, should take the lead in setting policy for the nation. 59%. Of Americans apparently don't understand that the President of the United States is also the Commander-in-Chief of the military. It's in the Constitution. Congress can authorize a war. Congress can vote funding for a war or not funding for a war. And there's a good and healthy and I think very reasonable debate about whether Congress actually ever authorized this war and whether George Bush broke the law in going to this war. You will recall Bush was running around saying, no, I don't want a war. I really don't want a war.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
You will recall he said that. And the resolution that was passed by Congress said that if Bush was going to use force in Iraq, he had to certify in writing to Congress that Iraq was somehow involved in 9/11, that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11. And George Bush, in fact, did write a letter to Congress right after the bombing started saying, we have evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11. And, I mean, you go back and you look, and it was just a bald-faced lie. So, in my opinion, first of all, it was, you know, Congress passed a resolution, not a declaration of war. So I don't personally think that there's legal authority for the war. Secondly, you could build a case, and this hasn't been done because you could build a case that there is no legal authority for this war. In fact, that George W. Bush committed high crimes and misdemeanors. He committed a crime worthy of at least impeachment by lying to Congress about what he knew, and then lying to the American people. I mean, you will recall there were inspectors in Iraq. Hans Blix was over there. This is from September 8th, 2002.
I'm not ever suggested that they were sort of willfully and consciously lying, but I think that they wanted to jump to conclusions.
Excuse me, 2003. Hans Blix, September 8th, 2003, speaking of the Bush administration. And how, I'll let him say it.
I said in the Security Council that if something is unaccounted for, it doesn't necessarily mean that they exist. And I think there was that tendency to jump to that conclusion. we were there for 3.5 months, after all, and we did not find any smoking gun. And now that the U.S. has been, the U.K. had been there for quite some time, and they had the opportunity to interrogate people, they had had the whole cream of the Iraqi establishment in custody, and people should not be scared any longer to answer in the interviews. With this long period, I'm inclined to think that the Iraqi statement that they destroyed all the biological and chemical weapons which they had in the summer of 1991 may well be the truth.
And that's what Hensblix was saying before we went to war. But Bush somehow hallucinated something different. I mean, consider this statement that George Bush made in a press conference when asked about why we went to war.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in.
Now, you hear that? It was not Saddam Hussein who kicked out the inspectors. Back in, I'm serious, I mean, back in 98, you had Scott Ritter in there for 6 or 7 years, and I believe it was in 98, Bill Clinton asked the UN to pull the inspectors out because it looked like Saddam Hussein had, you know, they were able to account for over 90% of all the weapons, but there was that small percentage that they couldn't account for. As Hans Blix says, that doesn't mean that it was there. It just means you can't account for it. But there were a few buildings that Saddam Hussein was being very touchy about. And so Clinton pulls Scott Ritter out and goes in and just bombs the hell out of those buildings. And says, okay, that's it. Now we know everything is gone. So Clinton pulled out the inspectors the first time. Then in 2002, when Bush starts talking about he wants to go to war with Iraq, the UN, you know, pulls together security resolution 1440 and sends in Hans Blix looking for chemical and biological weapons and conventional weapons, and Mohammed al-Baradei with the IAEA looking for nuclear weapons, and they're looking around for these weapons, and Bush says, we're going to attack Iraq, pull those guys out. It was Bush who pulled out the inspectors, not Saddam Hussein, and yet here's Bush, what he has to say.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in.
Lie.
And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
There you go. I mean, you know, where does this stuff come from? Can you imagine? I mean, Bill Clinton got impeached over lying about sex with a consenting adult, an over 21 consenting adult. Bill Clinton got impeached about lying about that. There hasn't even been a discussion about that lie, for example, that one of many. Not even a discussion. And now the U.S., you know, this is in the Wall Street Journal, 21% of Americans want Bush to lead, to set policy for the nation. 59% would prefer Congress to, with regard to this whole situation in Iraq. This is tragic. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. And welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. We have to convert concern, rage, whatever, you know, just all of that, all of those negative emotions. Convert it all into activism. Convert it all into doing something. Speaking up, speaking out, talking with friends around you, contacting your member of Congress, running for office, joining a political party, showing up at local groups or rallies, meetings. Let's get active. Grant in Toronto, Canada. Hey, Grant, thanks for calling. What's up?
Tom, not much. Great show, by the way. I've been listening to it for about a week. Kind of refreshing. I wasn't necessarily happy with progressive time slots, but you're definitely filling up this this gap in the day very well.
Thank you very much.
Just wanted to ask a quick question, and it's kind of like a MythBuster kind of, you know, debunking type question. Alex Jones, I heard you mention him, but I didn't hear what context.
Mm-hmm.
He's got this video floating around. I think you're probably aware of it, called Bohemian Grove.
Yeah, he among many others. And by the way, we've been in this time slot for 3.5 years, just for the record.
I'm a latecomer, but good to hear you doing what you're doing.
Yeah, with regard to Alex Jones, my comment about Alex, as I recall, and I would say this if he was on the phone with us right now. In fact, I have. He's been a guest on this program a number of times, and you know I have a lot of respect for Alex Jones. He pushes the envelope. I am very reluctant to say something unless I'm pretty sure that it's right, and I can back it up. And I think that Alex is more willing to get into things that are speculative. That's not good or bad. I don't mean that as a judgment. More often, I think he kind of gets dropped into the category of conspiracy theorists more often than perhaps I do. But he says a lot of good things. And the Bohemian Grove stuff, that's been around forever. The first that I learned about the Bohemian Grove was back when I was a teenager. Parade magazine did an article about it, and I have a friend whose father is a member of Bohemian Grove and has gone there a couple of times. A friend of mine who lives here in Portland, and in fact one time, I probably shouldn't name the name, but an internationally known American politician, major American politician, drunkenly peed on my friend's shoe as he was trying to pee on a tree. But the Bohemian Grove stuff is all there. I mean, they don't make a secret about it.
Do you have any kind of take on it? I know you don't want to kind of venture into speculation, but I'm a very progressive thinker, but at the time I was watching it going, is this like a noise machine thing? Is this to make any left opinion look bad, like if you buy into it? Or like,
no, I speaking of Alex's video, I don't know, because I can't say that I've actually watched that video. I've seen a lot of stuff on the Bohemian Grove, and I don't know which of it may have originated with him or which he may be pointing to. But speaking broadly of the Bohemian Grove, my sense of it, and as I said, I don't have firsthand, only secondhand experience with it, is that it's sort of like Skull and Bones. Frankly, this is my opinion of Skull and Bones as well. It's like, you know, a men's club. It's like a frat party kind of thing. And, you know, you get all these weird rituals and strange stuff going on and male bonding. But it's basically the place where the powerful and the mighty get to hang out with each other and let their hair down. And I'm not sure that it's, you know, there are people who are all worried that it's a satanic force that they're using, you know, all these pagan symbols and things. I don't think that there's a religious agenda there or anything like that. I think that, you know, whoever owns and runs the thing is probably making a pretty good buck at it, and it's a place where once a year the rich and powerful hang out. But, you know, I could be wrong. I mean, it might be something much more devious than that, but that's my sense of it.
No, most certainly, that's a fair take on it. I mean, like, I just caught, the irony of what they were, you know, purporting as some of the rituals, being that this is kind of a Republican sort of thing. So,
well, it's very conservative. I mean, you know, my friend who has been there twice, have said, you know, this is a bastion of conservative political perspective, but in as much as it's very corporatist. I mean, his dad is a major corporate, you know, the rich guy. I don't know how you say it, or whatever. And so, you know, that's the hangout place. But beyond that, you know, I'm frankly, you know, more concerned about the things that these people are funding, things like, you know, the think tanks, you know, the that are out there trying to influence American public opinion, than what they're doing when they get together and get drunk.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot,
Grant. I appreciate your take on it. Thank you very much.
Good to hear from you. It's I appreciate the call. 1-866-440-8466. Charles in Seattle. Hey, you've got Charles. We have to take a break at the bottom of the hour. It's going to hit us in about 20 seconds. But just set this thing up, and we'll come back to you right after the break.
Okay. And thanks for taking my call, and thank you for your forum and your enlightenment for us. This has to do with the lives in the balance issue, and it's a very disturbing email about a service person going to the doctor and discovering that there are no sinks in the hospital serving our people.
Our guys in Iraq. Yeah. Let me just put you on hold, and you can share a little bit of that with us when we come back. Yeah, our telephone number, 1-866, and thank you, Charles, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room or visit our message board, and all kinds of stuff all over the website. 27 minutes past the hour. the place where reason is our lifestyle's choice.
Got no time for grand philosophy. I'll barely keep my head above the tide. I got this mortgage, got three kids in school. What you're saying is the truth, but really troubles me inside. I'd change the world if I could change my mind.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman, 34 minutes past the hour. We were talking with Charles in Seattle. Hey, Charles. You were telling us about an email you received from a friend who's in Iraq.
Yeah, it's sent to many people and with my employer. I'll be honest, in the current environment, I'm almost a little nervous about sharing it. But it's
well,
so
you can, disturbing. You can just paraphrase it if you'd like. Just tell us what it says. It's probably better than reading it anyway.
Yeah, the person was sent to the doctor and noticed the doctor washing a cup in a sink and was impressed that he had a sink. And then he went on to say that it was a hot button issue and explained to her that when they're done stopping the bleeding, performing surgery or whatever, they have to try to wash the blood off their hands, arms, faces, and clothes with wet wipes or hand sanitizer. Because
they don't have safe running water?
Apparently. And she had they had no idea of this, and then went on to say that the person had seen the hospital and felt that it looked like something out of a horror movie or a film where they go do a documentary in an abandoned prison or something with dirty walls, paint peeling, yellow brown powder, dust everywhere.
This is in Iraq.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know,
these are the facilities that didn't Halliburton get the contract to provide fresh clean water to our troops and presumably also to our hospitals and has been charged by Henry Waxman with failing terribly in doing that?
Exactly, and this is why I think it's worth noting, because as we are preached to about supporting our troops, this is what these guys are doing to help our troops.
Yeah.
And I'm still kind of upset and shaky about it, to be honest, but I wanted to share it with you and your listeners, if only because, you know, we need to look at what is really supporting the troops, and are we really supporting the troops, or are we supporting this inner circle of cronies who are making billions of dollars off of this?
Yeah, the war profiteers. Good point, Charles. Thank you very much for the call.
Have a good day.
And you too. What this brings up is Harry Truman, really. The guy that George Bush keeps saying, they didn't think well of Truman when he left office, but when he died, everybody thought well of him. So they don't think well of me. But when I'm dead, they'll think well of me. That's the story George Bush is telling himself right now. That's what allows him to get out of bed every day and look himself in the mirror. And so Kofi Annan goes to the Harry Truman Library. What is it, in Joplin, Missouri, I think it is? It's someplace in Missouri. He goes to the Harry Truman Library to give his farewell speech. No symbolism there. And makes the point that Harry Truman is thought of well now by history because he respected human rights and the rule of law. It's in Independence, Missouri. Thank you, David. And that's rather different than George W. Bush. So I think, Kofi Annan, and I was amazed that the American media didn't pick this up and, just say it. Not even the bloviators, the talking heads. I mean, they don't even want to go near this stuff. Because basically the spectrum of what you see on American mainstream television goes from the right to the Reich. Didn't point out the fact that basically what Kofi Annan was saying is, George, history isn't going to remember you well. History's going to remember you the way that it did John Adams, as the guy who tried to destroy democracy, the guy who didn't respect human rights. George Bush says he's going to double down. As President Bush weighs new options for Iraq, this from the LA Times today, strong support has coalesced in the Pentagon behind a military plan to double down in the country with a substantial buildup in American troops. They're going to go after Muqtada al-Sadr. I'm telling you, the reason for doing this is to protect the Saudi royal family. Art in Seattle. Hey, Art, what's on your mind today?
Got a fast question, Tom.
Yeah.
If the Democratic senator from South Dakota, God forbid, is too ill to serve, and the GOP governor of South Dakota, who is a right-wing lunatic, replaces him.
Who signed the first abortion bill since Roe v. Wade that would put a woman in prison if she had an abortion, even if having the baby would cause her to die.
You got it. If this governor, this anti-abortion governor, replaces the senator with a Republican, which party in 2007 gets to choose the committee chairman? I couldn't sleep last night worrying about that.
Well, it would be the Republican Party, because you would then have a 50-50 Senate, and the tiebreaker would be Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney's only constitutional job, he has basically two constitutional jobs. One is to be the lady-in-waiting for the president, but the other is as president of the Senate. And so as president of the Senate, he, in the event of a tie, is the tie-breaking vote. And he's supposed to actually convene and lead the Senate, or at least I think that's what was envisioned by the founders when they changed the original definition of the vice presidency during Jefferson's presidency, as I recall. Nowadays, it rotates. It goes to different members of the Senate actually take that job. You recall Cheney saying, "I'm the president of the Senate. I don't remember seeing you there, Mr. Edwards."
But I thought that Darth Cheney would only get to exercise his Senate rights in the case of a vote. I didn't realize that his power extended to choosing the committee chairman, which is massive power.
Yeah, well, that's a vote.
Yeah, that's what I... Oh, I see.
See, I mean, you have a vote for who is going to be... Essentially, the way it works is the Senate votes on who's going to be the leader of the Senate, and the majority wins.
Yeah.
And then the leader of the Senate, it's Bill Frist right now. If it was Republican, I'm not sure who it would be. The obvious leadership is gone, Frist and Santorum. But... if it was, once that vote is taken, if there's a Republican majority, then whoever that Republican leader of the Senate is gets to pick who the committee chairs are.
You think there's a chance that Senator Snow, who's a good person, even though she's a Republican, might be convinced to become an independent?
It's really interesting. The Jim Jeffords moment. I was living in Vermont when Jim Jeffords changed parties. And Jim Jeffords is the only Republican, I think, in my life that I've ever voted for. When I was 13, I went door to door for Barry Goldwater in 64, but I wasn't old enough to vote. And by 67, I was, completely on the other side, anti-war and out there in the streets with the SDS.
Sure.
Jim Jeffords was a fundamentally decent guy, and I was living in Vermont, and he was running for re-election, and I actually voted for him, knowing that I was voting for a Republican, and that wasn't an election that was going to swing the Senate, by the way. It was 2 years before that. But Jeffords then, when the Republicans did gain control of the Senate in that election of 2000, Jeffords, as No Child Left Behind came down, he said, "I can't go along with this." In fact, his office shared with me, I contacted him, and I was writing Unequal Protection. The subtitle is The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. I was writing that book about the 1886 Supreme Court decision that made corporations persons and how it was phony and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so I contacted Jeffords' office, and I said, is there a corporation involved in this thing? this No Child Left Behind thing. And there's this Congressional Research Service that only members of Congress can go to for reports. And they had a report done for them, which is the thing that caused Jeffords to leave the Republican Party, which they shared with me, and I put part of in the book. And it said basically that the educational testing industry was about a $400 million a year industry. Companies, publishing tests and selling essentially 5 cents worth of paper to a school for $5, because there's intellectual property there. There's the copyrighted print on it. And it was about a $400 million industry. And that if No Child Left Behind passed, it would become a $1 billion industry within a year. In other words, there was huge money to be made and large lobbying done. And now we know that, Neil Bush, George's brother, is in that business. In fact, Barbara made her $30,000 contribution for Katrina contingent on the city of Houston, using that money to give to Neil Bush's company to buy stuff for, tests.
That's the savings of the loan, Bush.
Yeah, exactly. So anyhow, the bottom line is that when Jeffords did this act of conscience, it was really interesting how Vermont reacted. The entire state, I would say, even many of the Republicans in the state were like, yeah, this is the guy that we've always believed was a man of conscience and goodwill. And I suspect, from what I know of Maine, and I haven't spent a lot of time in Maine, but the Mainers are very, very independent people. And my guess is that if Olympia Snow, or for that matter, Susan Collins, although I think it's probably less likely for her, were to leave the Republican Party, if the Republican Party took power, and do like Jeffords did, that it may be a very actually good thing for her political career and maybe, you know, widely acknowledged in that state. But, you know, I wouldn't count anything out. I don't know. But, you know, let's all just hope that Tim Johnson is fine.
Absolutely.
You know.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Art. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-440-8466. Noah in Kenmore, Washington. Hey, Noah.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
Can you hear me all right?
I can. We've got to take a break in about a half a minute, though. What's you wanted to make a comment about the Bohemian Grove?
Yeah, here's the deal. As far as I understand, Alex Jones got in there about 2000 and got authentic footage of one of their main rituals called the Cremation of Care. In this ritual, they're conducting a mock human sacrifice of a childlike Ifti to this 45-foot stone owl that represents Molech, and they're straight up saying, "Be gone, foul care." Poison us not in our daily lives. And then, as I understand, a year later, the Grove came out and said, yes, this is authentic footage, but it's no big deal. It's just fraternal hijinks.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, if that's not about as demonic as can be, I have a hard time understanding what is.
Yeah, it's possible, no. It's possible. I'm not ruling it out. I just, you know, I don't. My sense of it is that that's not the case, that this is people pushing the envelope, you know,
we
making
take
fun
it
of themselves.
More seriously.
But perhaps we should. Noah, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Yeah, maybe. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where being progressive never felt so good.
So long, honey dear, where I'm bound, I can't tell. Goodbye is too good a word, babe. So I just say fairly well. I ain't saying you treated me unkind. You could have done better, but I don't mind. You just kind of wasted my precious time. Don't think twice, it's all right.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. And speaking of smart people and news, our senior Ahmed Chalabi correspondent Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., an accredited White House reporter, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Yes, good afternoon. How are you? Well, I hope.
I am fine. I have been watching the feeds on Tim Johnson. It seems that he is recovering normally.
It seems so. Exactly what normally means, you know, I don't think it's entirely clear.
Yeah.
It does seem as though it's going to take several weeks, but that doesn't seem to be any reason for him to be replaced.
Right, right. After all, I mean, you know, Strom Thurmond, they had to wheel him out in a wheelchair and prop him up and speak on his behalf for about 3 years. So.
As he managed to go around pinching bottoms all over the place.
Yes, that was about all he could do.
yes, but he managed to maintain enough of his faculties to do that, apparently.
Well, yeah, okay, I guess that's an argument for coherence. Anyhow, I see that the Associated Press, 26 minutes ago, as President Bush weighs new strategies for Iraq, the Army's top general warned Thursday that his force will break without thousands more active duty troops and greater use of the reserves. What's going on?
Well, we're short-staffed. They're fighting and dying, and there's a lot of them over there, and there's not many of them left anywhere else.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is General Peter Shoemaker saying this, and I thought that Bush was trying to get all the generals on the same, singing the same tune about we need more soldiers in there so that he could satisfy the demands that the Saudis made to Dick Cheney that we not allow Iraq to become a Shia-dominated country.
Now, we are not in any way, shape, or form to characterize any conversations that the king has with Dick Cheney. They have been friends for 17 years, I'll have you know, and their conversations are entirely private.
As a matter of fact, yes, I know all about that, and in fact, I just have to share this with our listeners. It's going to take just a second to load, but yesterday, our very own correspondent, Victoria Jones, taking on Mr. Snow.
Victoria. On the Saudi thing, I just want to clarify a couple of things. The Vice President and the King, you don't want to characterize their conversations, but you're not denying that they might have had a conversation about Saudi support.
What I would do is I would warn you against away from the story, and I will not characterize the conversation.
Right. But you're not denying that it could have taken place. You're just warning us.
They could have talked about the Boston Red Sox off-season plan for spending $50 million on a Japanese pitcher. So, I mean, the realm of theory is vast when it comes to conversations.
And it's unlikelihood,
indeed. Yeah, so Tony Snow doing a fast tap dance when you're asking him hard questions there, Victoria. Good on you.
Yeah, well, he did some tap dancing today when I asked Mike Chalabi, talking to the Syrian foreign minister over the weekend, and apparently, according to American diplomats, talking also trying to figure out ways that the Syrians can sort of finesse some kind of rapprochement with the Americans. I asked whether in what capacity he's operating for the United States, and he said, as far as he knew, in no capacity at all. And I pressed him on this, and he confessed that he didn't know.
Yeah, well, he's saying that a lot these days. Have you noticed?
Yes, he is saying he didn't know. But then he went on to kind of suggest that maybe Ahmad Chalabi might be making it up. And I said, what, Tony, I mean, are you suggesting that Ahmad Chalabi might make things up? And Tony was grinning so broadly as he couldn't wait to get on to the next questioner. He didn't know what to do with himself. He clearly...
Yeah.
Clearly knows exactly what Chalabi is.
Yeah, he'd been nailed and he knew it and he wasn't gonna. Yeah, interesting.
And he wasn't even trying to hide it.
Yeah. So how's, you know, Bush is basically saying that he's going to wait and he's going to take a Christmas vacation before he makes up his mind about what to do in Iraq, excuse me. And this isn't going over well with the American people.
No, it isn't. He'll be spending Christmas at Camp David, and I'm sure we'll be told that he'll be working extremely hard over the Christmas period on the Iraq plan, on the way forward, as it's called, as he tries to pull together all the pieces. But the American people are impatient. They do feel that people are fighting and dying, and that they've had the Iraq study report, which seems to be disappeared, kind of like somebody in Pinochet's regime,
yeah.
And they are not impressed.
Yeah, and a presidential spokesman said James Baker should go back to his day job, and apparently he has. He stopped speaking in public.
Yeah, you're right. They've all gone silent, haven't they?
Yeah, it's just boom. It's like it never happened. It's like the word came down from the Godfather. You know, it's the parallels between this administration and your generic organized crime family are sometimes chilling. Frankly. So anyway, we have about 30 seconds here, Victoria. Final news from out of Washington, D.C.?
Final news is that it was a wonderful Christmas party last night.
At the White House?
Fabulous. We had our Christmas party last night at the White House. I had my annual grip and grin with the President of the United States.
Uh-huh. And how did he look?
He looked a bit gray, actually. I mean, partly it was a gray suit, but he looked gray to me.
Yeah. I would have to think that, you know, doing this dance on behalf of the Saudis now would have to be wearing on him. Victoria, thank you for the report.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Coming up tomorrow, as every Friday at noon for the last 3 years, Bernie Sanders. Now, Senator Bernie Sanders will be here taking your calls and... I'm not making this up. Jim Rutz is here. He's the chairman of Megashift Ministries, and he's saying, don't drink soy milk. It makes you gay. Yes, he's anti-soy latte. That and more and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Remember, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.